Hi, Calvin. We're back, and you were just talking about the increased amount of electromagnetic energy fields as it interacts with the spinning of the electron in a deuteron container, and why it can only take squared numbers, and how it will need to regulate any differences if it is not a squared number of electromagnetic energy field that is added or subtracted.
Yeah. So, as we were saying, a fast-moving electron attracted via the law of interaction, the electric field interactions between the two particles, to a lower energy deuteron will release its energies, just as per normal spectral lines. Higher energies must drop down to a lower ground state, determined by the energy of the deuterons. So if it has to do that, it releases a number of bosons which can form photons, but it releases a set number of odd number quantum levels and transitions between them. Conversely, if you want to break an electron free from, say, an N1, you have to add energy to it so it can go from 1 squared to at least something above 8 squared. 8 squared, it would still be part of the atomic nuclei. As such, its energies are increasing. Once it gets above the energy level of 8 squared, it has enough energy or chem field energy pushing it, or trying to push it in one direction, to break it free or to overcome the Coulombic attraction between the electron and the proton. So there's sufficient energies, usually something in excess of, most figures are stated at 13.6. Quick calculation on tetrionics gives an exact number, 13.525, as illustrated at the top right. Anything in excess of 13.525 will be sufficient to overcome the Coulombic attraction between the proton and the electron, and will break it free of the atomic nuclei with some excess energy, which is why it's always going to be that little bit more, 13.6, for example, just above 13.525. You need that extra little bit, because it's not enough just to break or to equalize the attraction between the positive and the negative. You have to have a little bit more energy to get motion in one direction. And again, as you increase the energy from N1 through to N2, N3, N4, etc., up to N8, the spin of the electron while it's bound increases and increases. The moment it breaks free, what was angular momentum is converted, because the electron's no longer pinned about its axis. It's able to move freely in one direction, and it moves in the direction of the chem field at a specific velocity, which again can be calculated via mv squared. So we've now related Bohr's, or the Bohr radius, and the transitions between atomic levels, and why atomic levels are the way they are, why an electron has a ground state for certain levels or atomic shells, K, L, M, N, etc., all relate to N1, N2, N3, N4, and they're all determined by the energy of the deuterons. That's what 1808 is really summarizing again. What we show is on the top left, the electron with its matter topology and its associated chem field. The quantum levels from N1 through to N8. So as we increase the energies of the chem field, we're increasing the energy, the ionization energy of the electron. If it's bound to an N2 deuteron, we'd have to accelerate it to N3 in order to break it away from the N2 deuteron with sufficient energy to move forward. Again, it's still just a form of acceleration. However, while the electron's energy is less than the deuterons, it will always remain bound to that deuteron in the atom. So hence why you've got to add more energy than the ionization energy to break it free. And as that illustration shows, the ionization energy is just essentially a measure of the chem field kinetic energies. But the matter of the electron never changes. And again, we can use various forms of math to calculate the energy required. But we know for hydrogen, for example, we need 13.6 volts to exceed the 13.525 in order to break it free. Once the electron's broken free, it's free to release energy quanta in any amount that it wants. It doesn't have to obey squared energy levels because its energy isn't determined by the deuteron. So this also explains why when electrons are bound to atomic nuclei, their transitions are always between squared numbers, because the deuteron's dictating what energy level the electron can have. You need a free deuterium nuclei, one without an electron, in order to put an electron in there, and that electron must match the energy levels of the deuteron that it binds to. If it doesn't, it'll be forced to either increase its energy or decrease its energies to match it, and they'll always be a squared number. That formula can also be formulated, the transitions between the energy levels via, I think it's pronounced Rydberg's formula, it could be Rydberg's, depending who you're talking to. A complex formula was never fully explained as to why it's 1 over n squared minus 1 over n squared for initial and final energy levels. But again, tetrionics does that. When we talk about spectral lines, we've done that before, but we can do it again later. 1903 just elaborates on this magnetic moment, or magnetons as they're sometimes termed, and tries to clarify where tetrionics deviates from relativity. Again, the leptons, as we've said, or electrons in this case, are 12-loop inductive charge rotors. Long word, basically it means that the unique geometry or topology of leptons is just like a three-phase rotor in electrical engineering. If you build a three-phase rotor, you have the same topology as what electrons are when you build the paper models using the templates in tetrionics. From the side, they look like the central picture there, and from the top, they look like the left-hand or right-hand side. Now, when they're in motion, either direction, as per the illustration on the right-hand sides, a chem field is generated. You move to the right, the chem field points to the right. You move to the left, the chem field points to the left. If the particle was standing still and had excess EM field energy, it would have both a left and a right combined. But that left and right would have no magnetic moment, so you would see a point charge with a field of interaction. If it's in motion, you only have one triangle, as I said, pointing in the direction of motion, and a magnetic moment becomes apparent. You get a defined magnetic dipole. As per the illustrations on the right-hand side further down, you have a north-south or a south-north dipole, depending on your frame of reference and the direction of particle motion along with the charge of the particle involved. So all these things are important because we have to, as we've done, we have to explain relativistic contraction, the lack of a magnetic moment in a charged particle at rest, and the creation of a magnetic moment when the particle's in motion, and the particular orientation. Different charged particles create different magnetic moments. As we've touched on before with the different charges moving in different directions in parallel wires, the equilateral geometry comes to the rescue, sitting down, working out the left and right hand rules for positive and negative charge particles to figure out their fields of interaction is far more cumbersome than drawing a triangle pointing in the direction of motion with a magnetic dipole reflective of the charge of the particle that's in motion. We can, as per the center bottom picture, we can then use these triangles for the particles in motion in different directions to explain not only the presence of a magnetic moment, but also Ampere's law of attraction and repulsion between the particles. So it covers the Ampere force, it covers the Lorentz force, because the particles moving in the same direction, those chem fields will touch or interact with the particles in front of them and accelerate or attract those particles depending on their charge, as per Coulomb's law of attraction. So what you get is, with a series of electrons in motion, a current, you get a train of these waves, one chem field behind the other, with the particle resting on the chem field that it's created, and they start to push each other along, just like carriages in a train. They will maintain the position, or the separation between the particles of similar charge. They repel each other according to their velocities. If one's moving faster behind the other, it will accelerate the slower one in front of it. They all affect, because the wave of the faster particle acts on the slower particle in front and pushes, just like a surfboard does. The analogy is quite apt. But what's important, as I keep pointing out, is that all those properties explained by equilateral geometries of chem fields now completely replace the idea expressed on the left-hand side, which is the relativistic model or explanation of those processes. Relativity says that you start with a spherical, perfectly spherical, minus one elementary charge. Tetrionics says it's a negative 12. Topology, very specific quantum rotor topology. Tetrionics has a problem, and quantum mechanics has a problem, in that a perfectly spherical charge, which is what, under Gauss's rules, must be evenly distributed around a spherical surface or topology, can't explain where a magnetic moment comes from. Relativity, and Einstein in particular, attempted to explain it by saying, well, when the particles move, the mass matter of the particle gets distorted, hence that distorted oval that you see there. The particle, as it moves faster and faster, is squashed out of shape, distorted, and that distortion creates the magnetic moment that we measure. Whereas Tetrionics says, no, it's the chem field. The particle doesn't change. The mass energies of the chem field increase, their wavelengths contract, and the magnetic moment and kinetic energies, linear momentum and velocity, increase. All covered. So where you see length contraction in relativity, we can now restate length contraction to actually be wavelength contraction of the mass energy in the chem field. So we've now separated the surfboard from the wave, and we show that the energy of motion is in the wave. It's using that energy of motion in the wave to accelerate the surfboard rider, or the rider and his surfboard. But at no time does any molecule within the board or the rider contract. Only the wavelengths of the energy in the chem field, or the energies of the wave, the EM wave. That is the only thing that changes. And they contract and expand as per the velocity changes or the acceleration of the particle or the surfboard rider in this analogy. 1905 just illustrates the same thing, but it explains electron spin. These electrons are quantum rotors, as I said, that when they're in a atomic nuclei, deuterium nuclei, they can rotate. They're pinned via their magnetic axis, and they rotate in one of two directions, forward or backward, if you like, or up and down, left and right in some cases, depending on the orientation of the deuterium nuclei. But irrespective, and this entire region of or discussion of electron spin can get rather complicated as well, particularly if you're studying up on it. What tetrionics does is uses the chem field geometry to redefine and elaborate on what the spin really is. When it's bound, when an electron is bound, or any lepton is bound to an atomic nuclei, its vector velocity or linear momentum is converted to angular. So linear motion is converted to rotational motion, spin. In the Stern-Gerlach experiment, where electrons are accelerated through magnetic fields and their spin is measured, what they're really measuring is the deflection of the electron in one direction or the other. And what, in that case, they're really measuring is the interaction between the external magnetic field and the magnetic moment of the electron. You can see here in the center of the picture, you have the electron moving in two directions. So its chem field points in two directions. You have a magnetic moment that's created in both cases, but because of the geometry of the negative field, the dipoles change orientation depending on which way the electron is actually spinning or in motion. As the electron moves through the external field, you've got two different orientations of that magnetic dipole. It, depending on the orientation of the external field, it bends one way or the other. Its path of motion, it's deflected. It's the interaction of the external with the magnetic moment, external magnetic field with the magnetic moment of the electron in motion that determines the spin. In tetrionics, we simply draw the triangles as per their direction of motion, and that explains spin. And it becomes particularly important, as illustrated on the right, to further reference the spin of the electron with respect to the magnetic moment of the nuclei it's bound to, in the case of spin in elements. So firstly, for the spin, I won't go into too much detail, but I will touch on it. As you can see in that right-hand side illustration, an electron can move left or right with respect to a nuclei. In this case, we have a proton, in the case of a hydrogen atom, for example. The proton has its own magnetic moment, depending on which way it's moving. And it has a north-south magnetic dipole pointing, with a chem field pointing in direction of motion. Once we measure and determine the magnetic moment of the proton or the nuclei, we then look at the electron's magnetic moment, which depends on which direction it's moving, left or right. And then we compare that to the magnetic moment of the proton. If the north-south, south-north are in the same orientation, say that in both cases, as per that illustration there, the nuclei is moving to the right with a north-south magnetic moment. If you look up at the top, and the electron is moving to the left, it also has a north-south magnetic moment. So in both cases, the north poles are parallel, the dipole is parallel, for starters, and we have two north poles side by side, which will tend to repel. So that's called a parallel magnetic moment, where the dipoles, the magnetic vector, both point the same way, north-south, south and north-south. So they're parallel. They have more energy because being parallel, the two norths and the two souths will want to push those two dipoles apart. There's more energy in the system. But if the electron was spinning the other way and it had a south-north dipole or moment, then you would have a south-north on the electron and a north-south on the proton. They would be parallel, but they would be opposite directions for the magnetic vector, so they'd be anti-parallel magnetic moments. And they're actually drawn together because north-south attracts, south-north attracts. So they would come together and they'd have what's termed as less energy because they don't want to push apart. They're held together. But conversely, it takes more energy to separate the two. The final point in there is that the electric field, as you can see there, can also be re-termed, instead of an electric and a magnetic field, to be a measure or measured by or calculated by Dirac's constant, which is Planck's constant divided by 2 pi. Geometrically, it's the same as a photon. It's the chem field, 4 pi mv squared divided by 2, the electric component. It's really a measure of the reduced Planck constant, as it's sometimes called, or Dirac's constant, is really a measure of the interaction between charged particles. And that's the E field interaction, the Coulombic attraction, or interaction, I should say, because there's always a push-pull bidirectional force between the two particles. So whether you define it as Dirac's or reduced Planck or kinetic energy or electric permittivity, same geometries, same fields. 2801 just recapitulates the chem field and its importance and how we determine the quanta within that field. You can see on the left and right hand sides, we just have illustrations of the chem field with increasing energies. As the energy increases from N1 to N8, the number of quanta increases. But the wavelength of those quanta is Lorentz contracted, relativistically contracted, so that as there's more energy, the Planck quanta becomes smaller to fit into the same size field, and the particle moves faster. You can see in this illustration that I've deliberately gone and highlighted in the central picture the chem field with its kinetic energy component, the blue triangle, which is the field of Coulombic interaction, the magnetic dipoles, which are the ampere forces of attraction, or Ampere's law. And you can see that in this case, the linear momentum is a series of pink triangles. And I'll just touch on that because it's an important point. The vector velocity that's created is the square root V. Linear momentum is mass velocity. So it's not just an arrow. Velocity is the arrow that you see on most illustrations. Mass velocity is velocity with a cross product of mass, scalar mass. So therefore, it's not an arrow per se. It's actually a series of triangles. And that's borne out by the fact that linear momentum is the square root of scalar energies. Now, we know that the scalar energies of a chem field is mv squared, or h nu squared. So if we count the quanta there, for this case we have 81 quanta, which you'll see reading down the right-hand side of the triangle. There's 81 quanta in that chem field. The square root of 81 is 9. So therefore, we need 9 triangles for the linear momentum. 1, if you count the pink one starting at the V going down, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and the 9th is hidden under the electron itself. But the square root of that equilateral field, the linear momentum, or the square root linear momentum of the scalar energy, is the pink photons, right? The median bisector. The actual vector line represents the velocity or the vector direction. So it's important not to confuse the two in tetrionics. It's something I didn't illustrate for a long time, but it's been corrected in most of the illustrations. If you're talking linear momentum, you're talking these pink triangles, photons, if you like. If you're talking vector velocity, it's just a vector or linear line, a straight arrow. Again, you can see in this illustration, looking left to right in the same chem field, that each energy level has an odd number of quanta, 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, and the addition of those quantas, 1 plus 3 gives you 4. 1 plus 3 plus 5 gives you 9. Plus 7 gives you 16, and so on. It's the transverse quantum levels, or transverse bosons, that make up, that create the transitions between squared energy levels. Now, the squared energy levels, as I've said before, relate to the bound energies of photoelectrons. Once the electron breaks free, it can be any number of quantum, better to express it as any energy level within a squared geometry, within an equilateral geometry. Again, they'll always be a squared number of quanta because of the shape, but that energy level can be any number, whereas it's fixed numbers within when it's bound to within an atomic nuclei. So the important point here is that the matter doesn't change. It's always an electron, always the same size, always the same mass, always the same charge. They're all conservative, non-Lorentz contractive or non-relativistic properties of the particle. What is relativistic are these mass energies in the chem fields. It's the wake that's important, which is normally, as we say, hasn't been differentiated. It's all treated as energy in physics at the moment. Tetrionics separates mass, which is a immaterial, a spiritual component, if you like, to particles in motion, from the material components or the material topology, 3D closed volumes of the particle itself. In tetrionics, I try to say mass energy fields versus material topologies or material particles. I usually reserve particle for matter and use fields for mass energy. Recapitulates all that we've just discussed. At the top of the picture, you can see the absorption and the emission of photons from a nuclei, or from a photoelectron in particular, following the Bohr radii, except instead of jumping away various distances from the nuclei, we now know it's bound, and that all that's happening is that the energies of the chem field are increasing as per Rydberg's formula. We don't have to use the formula anymore. We can simply look at a chem field as illustrated in the center at the top and just calculate the number of quanta between any transition. In this case, it's an N5 to an N1, or it could be the other way around. It could be N1 to N5. The only thing that changes is the direction of the arrow with the R. The R star stands for Rydberg, but it's a measure. Rydberg's formula is a measure of wavelength. It's actually the inverse of wavelength. It counts the number of Planck quanta along the length of that arrow. But it's the same thing. It can all be related back for another discussion through the equilateral geometry. We can see that it's a transition between 1, N1 and N5, or squared energy levels of 1 and 25, in which case all we do is we know that the kinetic field has mass times velocity, so we're talking 12 times 25 versus 12 times 1, mass times velocity squared. So to go from N5 to N1, we simply have to we have to go from 1 to 300, as illustrated there. In order to do that, we have to gain or lose 288 quanta. That's what that illustration is all about. There's many more of them in the spectral line discussions, but in essence, we simply draw the illustration of the equilateral or squared numbers, and we calculate the difference between the two. I call them quantum differentials, hence the plus or minus delta H nu. And H nu, the sum of H nu is always an odd number, the sum of H nu makes H nu squared. So the sum of the odd numbers equals the squared number for the change between whichever squared number you want to go to. Various ways of mathematically calculating it. It's really simpler to use the equilateral geometries. At the bottom, I then just try to illustrate a common interaction between an EM wave and a photoelectron. Whether it's bound to the atomic nuclei or whether it's free makes no real difference. In this case, we have a N1 photoelectron at the left-hand side, and it interacts, as it moves through space, it interacts with a photon of a specific energy level, which again is the specific frequency and has a specific number of Planck quanta in it, the Planck number being double that of the frequency, because there's two bosons to every photon. When it interacts, you see that the electron doesn't change. What changes is that the chem field jumps up to a higher energy level, goes from red to aqua. So the energies of the photon are absorbed in the chem field. We measure that, as you can see in the illustration, via its magnetic moment, or we measure its total mass energies. Either way, the magnetic moment gets stronger because it has more mass energy in the chem field, and the total mass energy, the relativistic energies of the particle, which is its matter, plus its mass energies, increases because the mass energies of the chem field have increased. And coincidentally, the wavelengths of the chem field, of the photons and bosons of the Planck quanta in the chem field, have contracted, but the matter hasn't changed. Now, that electron may travel along quite happily as it is, faster, or something might happen where it slows down, which is the right-hand side of it. If it slows down to a given velocity, in this case the same as what it started with, it has to give up all those excess energies in the chem field via way of photons. It can release individual photons or bosons, or it can release just an EM field, any form of electromagnetic radiation. There's no virtual particle interactions. There's no change in the matter of the particle at all. It's the identical particle. It has the same mass. You look at the figures. The capital M equals 8.851 by 10 to the minus 3 kilograms in all three cases. But what changes is the kinetic energies of the chem field, the energies of motion. And that's the essence of absorption and emission. And again, the chem fields, the quanta in the chem field can be calculated by multiplying the square of the velocity by the mass matter of the particle, mv squared. And we can then divide that number by Planck's constant to calculate how many Planck quanta are in that field for any given one of those three systems. Any field interaction can be calculated, as shown in that illustration. So again, it sort of highlights a particle or a boat moving at a certain speed. It then interacts with a wave, or it gets accelerated to a higher energy. The boat hasn't changed shape, form, or anything. All that's happened is it's gained speed. It's got a bigger wake, but the boat hasn't changed. But then over time, the boat might slow back down to go into port, and it has to release those energies. As it slows down, the wake gets smaller, and the energies of motion are released back out into the water, or a reverse thrust is applied, either one. 2903 just highlights relativistic or Lorentz corrections with respect to mass energies of chem fields. Now, remember again, matter does not change. So the mass energy content of matter stays the same, no matter how fast the particle's moving. What does change are these quanta within the field. As the particle increases velocity, the number of quanta has to increase. In order to do that, you have to put more quanta into the same size field. Physically, the length or the wavelength of those quanta must contract. It's like winding up a spring, if you like. The more energy you put into the spring, the more quanta you put into that triangle, the faster it can make that particle go. And it's not an appropriate analogy, but it's a good analogy for those trying to get their head around it. It's basically putting more and more triangles into the same size charge field, the chem field. As those quanta are crammed in, their wavelengths must contract. And equally, as energy is released from that field, as the spring is unwound, the wavelengths become longer. And that's exactly what Lorentz contractions are about. Although they were usurped in relativity by Einstein to cover a nebulous idea of everything being energy, as he tried to explain magnetic moments, inductors working with bar magnets, and relativistic motion with one particle in motion with reference to the other. It plays a role, but the model is incorrect, and that's what tetrionics sets out to do. So in the center of the picture, you see that we have the full tetrionic picture of a particle in motion. We have matter, we have kinetic energies, and we have total relativistic energies. They all remain the same as per the calculations, but what changes is we separate the material particle from the mass energy field. And that's what the formula in the center is all about. Again, those familiar that have been following the discussions will be familiar with it. Everybody knows E equals mc squared, and a lot of physicists have trouble explaining what exactly it means. E equals mc squared simply says that the amount of energy per c squared is equivalent to the measurement of mass. Energy divided by c squared equals mass. So mass and energy are equivalent. But because physics hasn't defined matter or separated matter after its definition, differentiated, it can't take the next step. E equals m times c squared, which is just another way of saying E equals mv squared. But algebraically, if you say E equals mc squared, you must also question what m divided by c squared is. And in tetrionics, we show that just as mass is a measure of energy per c squared, if we were to divide mass by c squared, we get energy divided by c to the fourth. which is a measure of matter. What does it really mean? Geometrically, it's the same energy divided by c squared by c squared, which is a spherical spatial coordinate system. Because mass is just a planar field, you only need c squared. You can still measure it by measuring it with a spherical field, and that's what relativity does. Relativity converts everything, including matter, back into energy. All the mass, all the matter, becomes just a stress energy tensor within divided by c to the fourth, which is a spherical coordinate system. But it says nothing about the shape of the energy, what is mass, what is matter, and more importantly, what their roles are, which is why it resorts to relativistic distortions, point charges, etc. Tetrionic says matter is energy divided by c to the fourth, mass is energy divided by c squared. All those are in that picture, but what we're interested in for relativistic corrections is not the matter, it's the mass energy. The mass energy within the matter doesn't change, only the mass energy within chem fields is what we're interested in, because the mass energy in matter circulates endlessly at the speed of light, which is why the mass released from matter follows E equals mc squared. It's actually M equals mc squared in the case of releasing mass from matter, yet another formula. But what we're doing is we're firstly elaborating the true formula for mass and matter, and we've also now separated, defined and separated mass from matter and from energy that makes both of them up. But in doing so, we can now show that the relativistic corrections that Lorentz devised apply to the chem fields, or the mass energy of the chem fields, not to the matter itself. The formulas don't change, apart from saying gamma is actually wavelength contraction and things like that, but we radically change the models for both mass energies, in that we have equilateral foundations, geometric foundations, and we have radically different models for the hitherto point charges of these particles, where we now show that charge determines the topology of the particles. By measuring the charge, we're determining what the topology of that particle is. That's something that's unknown in physics at present. To physics, charge is just a measured property. It's something that comes about through some process. We now show that it's an inherent property of the equilateral geometry of EM fields and of Planck quanta themselves, that the asymmetric distribution of Planck quanta in the chem fields associated with matter in motion determines the fields of interaction. It determines their velocity, determines the Lorentz contraction and how much mass energy is in the particles, and determines things like Ampere's law, Coulomb's law of attraction, etc., and explains all of that. 40.02, again, just redraws the chem field, but this time, along with the energies increasing, I've also drawn in the linear momentum, as well as the vector velocities, and related them all back to Lorentz corrections. If you see the Lorentz correction beta, which is velocity divided by c, you now know from tetrionics that the velocity is the apex of the triangle, c is the base of the triangle, the velocity being the median bisector. It's the vector force or vector direction. And as the velocity increases with respect to C, the wavelengths, as you can see from the illustration there, contract. As you get more and more linear momentum and vector velocity, those triangles or those diamonds become smaller and smaller and smaller. Beta squared, which is the other Lorentz contraction, which is the scalar correction factor, is velocity squared per c squared. We know that c squared is the spatial coordinate or spatial region for measuring planar geometries of mass energy. And we know that every chem field has mass velocity squared or Planck nu squared quanta within that field. Doesn't matter whether you use mass velocity, Newtonian classical mechanics, or whether you use Planck nu squared for quantum mechanics, the answers still come out the same, just the units change. Energy versus mass velocity or linear momentum. The vector and linear forces are measured by beta. Beta squared is the scalar. And the easiest way to describe that is vector is a arrow or a directional force, which is what the linear momentum is in tetrionic illustrations. Scalar is a surface area. It's a region. And that's the quanta within the equilateral field itself. So again, all the Lorentz corrections, whether they're increases or decreases, scalar or linear, can all be related back to tetrionic geometries of mass energy. Nothing to do with the matter. Once the mass energies are in the matter, they're fixed. But any particle in motion has a differing velocity, and it's those changes of velocity that bring about changes of energy, changes of wavelength, changes of frequencies in spectral lines. Measurements of the changing linear momentum is what Newton used for accelerations to produce acceleration curves, etc. Leibniz used scalar energy, mv squared versus mv for Newton. They're all interrelated via the geometry, and the geometry gives us all these relationships. Not the math, it's the geometry that is the foundation of physics. The mathematics simply describes the underlying geometry. 4008 simply elaborates on what I call Einstein's error of perception. As I've said before, he sought to explain how a rest point particle of charge with no magnetic moment suddenly develops a magnetic moment when it's accelerated. And the faster you accelerate it, the stronger that magnetic moment becomes, and the more mass energy that particle is measured as having, because they measure it via the kinetic energies or by the deflection. But it's the kinetic energies, and then they just reverse the formulation. You know the velocities, you know its rest mass, you can calculate the mass energies of the particle in motion. It's obviously changing. What's the solution? His solution was to employ Lorentz contractions or corrections for accelerating particles and to say that the total energies are relativistically contracted, or the point spherical point particle is distorted to create the magnetic moment. Tetrionic corrects it, as we've said before in this discussion, by defining mass and matter, topologies and geometries, through charged Planck quanta. It's charge, it's the equilateral geometry of Planck quanta that brings about charge. It's charge that creates chem fields pointing in a particular direction with their magnetic moments. Those chem fields get stronger and more pronounced as more energy is added to the field or more forces applied. The particles are accelerated to higher and higher velocities. And it's the same charges with their associated mass energies that create rigid, solid 3D matter topologies that never change. Once the particle is created with its mass energies, it doesn't change. All electrons have the same number of quanta in their charged fascia, and they have the same rest mass, and that rest mass is identical to its mass matter in motion. But what changes is the energy of this EM wave. The wave literally, well, the particle is literally surfing on this electromagnetic wave of energy. It's a boat and its wake, the rider and the wave. And all these properties are easily drawn geometrically. We can draw the mass with the matter, or we can strip one from the other to determine the properties. But the important point is that the matter is invariant. The mass energies of the chem field change according to the acceleration of the particle. It's nothing like what the current relativistic models of spherical point particles is all about. Not at all. They're completely different. 40.11 just summarizes a typical equation you'll find in relativistic mechanics. On the left hand, well, in the center, you see, start firstly with the top left hand corner. Currently in QED, we have Feynman diagrams. In this case, we have two electrons moving towards each other from the bottom of the illustration towards the top in the direction of the time arrow. As the particles, as the electrons move towards each other, they exchange a virtual particle. They interact somehow magically, and a lot of this comes to do with the interaction at a distance where there's no physical contact between the particles, and why the particles suddenly veer away in the case of electrons, because similar charges repel. Tetrionics on the left, on the right-hand side, we now show that exact same situation with two particles moving towards each other, although in this case they're moving in opposite directions at the same time, over time. But as they move towards each other, the material particles don't interact with each other, but their chem fields do. Specifically in this case, because we're modeling Ampere's law, specifically the magnetic moments interact. You'll note that the kinetic energy, the electric fields, don't touch in this case, so Coulomb's law doesn't come into effect in the case of Ampere's law to a great deal, but the magnetic fields, magnetic moments, do come into effect. And as they cross over, superposition, we have the old rule, as we discussed early in the discussion, of north-south, south-north, depending on the charge of the particle and its direction of motion. And you'll either have an attraction or a repulsion. So in the case of two electrons moving in the same direction, you would have a north-south and a north-south dipole arrangement, which would cause a repulsion. You'd have, you'd have an attraction moving in the same direction. Moving in opposite directions, you have a repulsion. This is where it all gets confusing unless you follow the geometries or revert back to the Ampere's law and the left-hand, right-hand rules. What's of import, well, is the distribution of Planck quanta in the chem fields. So again, the chem field distribution is determined by the charge of the particle in motion. So a negative particle in motion would have a field like the bottom right-hand illustration, where there are more negative quanta than there are positive. The negatives actually form around the outside, if you like, and then you have another layer of positives surrounding a negative, and it keeps cycling that way. But there are more negative than positives, and for a positive particle, you'll have more positives than negatives, as per the right-hand side. Again, wherever those two fields superposition or overlap, you can either have Ampere's law or Coulomb's law of interaction, in which case you could re-express Coulomb's law as the kinetic energy squared, or the total interactions, Ampere's and Coulomb's interaction, as the total energy squared. As you can see in the background, there's capital E for the energy of both fields squared, which is the electric and the magnetic. Or if you're talking Coulomb's charge interaction, you're just talking the kinetic energies. Ampere's would be the magnetic interactions. If we quickly take those the formulations mathematically, the energy of a system is mass velocity squared, which can be re-expressed as the linear momentum by the velocity, mv by v, which is mv squared. Or we can look at the kinetic energies, which is kinetic energy squared, depending on what we're looking at, whether we're looking at the total electromagnetic or just the magnetic energies. We can then re-express energy squared or kinetic energy squared as mass velocity squared, which would be Planck squared, quanta squared, or mass omega squared, velocity squared squared. Gets confusing. I won't elaborate, work through the formulas are there. But squaring mass velocity squared gives you m squared v squared, v to the fourth. Squaring pv will give you p squared v squared. And if you want the kinetic energy, it's obviously half of those fields, hence the divided by 2. Equally, because we're dividing by 2, you could also do the same thing for the magnetic moments if you're looking at the dipole. Or if you're looking at a particular field, you could divide it by 4. Geometrically, you can begin to see how these dividing by 4, dividing by 2, etc., all come into play. But the geometry certainly gives substance to the mathematics. Again, kinetic energy is a half mv squared, which is the same as linear momentum squared divided by 2 masses, photons, well, the scalar energy divided by the photons. All these formulas take play there. They're all on that page for everyone to get their head around. Just to summarize and to throw in the final extension of these, the wave side of thing of mass energies versus material topologies, we go back in illustration 40.15 to what I call the coupling constants. And this highlights why Coulomb's law of attraction, or interaction as I call it, is identical, save M and K, to the formulation for Newton's law of gravity. I won't say gravitation for a reason we'll discuss later. But at the top of the page of 40.15 for coupling constants, you can see Coulomb's law of charge interaction, rewritten slightly, but the force of the charge interaction is proportional to the Q1, Q2 divided by the distance, or the square of the distance, and related through coupling constant K. And that's why I reworded it the way it is, or reformulated it. Newton's formula for gravity, or gravitation as it's normally referred to, on the right hand side, the force is proportional to M1, M2 over the square of the distance between them by a coupling constant minus G. Now, you can ignore the minus at this stage because the minus is there to say that gravity is a purely unidirectional force. It's always attractive. There is no such thing as repulsive gravity. Well, when you begin to understand mass and matter, and in particular mass energy fields, with their asymmetric quanta will show that that's a generalization. It's a net attractive force. It's actually comprised of attractive and repulsive quanta for a reason. Well, I'm not here to say that there are attractive and repulsive gravity, or that gravity is a push-pull arrangement. Gravity is different, and hence why we have a differing formulation for Newton's gravity to what we have for Einstein's gravity in general relativity, but they're explaining the same thing. That aside, the reason why Newton's law of formulation for gravity is so similar to Coulomb's law of charge interaction is because of the geometry of mass energy, particularly Planck quanta themselves, that make up EM fields. Doesn't matter whether we're talking about EM or electrostatic or chem fields or BEM fields or even GEM fields. Irrespective, they're all made up of equilateral quanta. Those quanta come together to form larger and larger EM fields, or if you're measuring energy per C squared, increasing amounts of mass energy with a inverse wavelength or frequency wavelength relationship. Now, on the left hand side, we can see two charges, in this case an electron and a positron, and we don't see the charges themselves because they're matter. So the material side of things doesn't matter in what we're talking about here, no pun intended. It's the fields of mass energy that are important, because they are what create interaction or communicate information about one particle's charge and its mass energy to another particle, and communicate information about the velocity of the particle, more importantly, and its direction. All that information is contained in that chem field and its orientation with respect to another particle's chem field. Where they overlap, they don't always overlap as illustrated there, but in an ideal case, two particles, in this case a positive and negative charge particle, are attracted towards each other via their chem fields. Everything about those respective particles is all the information that needs to be communicated from one particle to the other, so far as whether it should be attracted or repelled, how fast the other particle is going, how big the other particle is, what its charge is, etc., what its magnetic moments, what its kinetic energy is. All that's conveyed from one particle to the other via these chem fields, or EM fields in general. Where they overlap, you have a superposition or interacting energy momenta, and that energy momenta is what the coupling constant K, in the case of charged fields, is calculating for. It's a coupling constant, and as soon as you see constant in tetrionics or in physics, you should relate it back to a geometry, one form or the other. In this case, K and G, because they're inverse squared constants, have a diamond or rhombic geometry to them, and they're measuring the energy or the strength, the number of electromagnetic quanta, in the case of Coulomb's law, between the two particles. So where they overlap, the number of quanta between those two particles, which is always determined by the inverse, the square of the distance between them. As you get further away from the positive electric charge, it gets weaker. Same thing for the electric. But in between the two particles where they overlap, you have all these quanta. The electric fields are interacting for the electric interaction of charge. On the right-hand side, we have the gravitational interaction of matter. And again, we only have illustrated a unidirectional. We don't have a bidirectional interaction. The arrows only point one way towards the matter. But in both cases, One's a measure of newton meters squared per coulomb squared. In the case of newtons, it's newton meters squared per kilogram squared. One's a measure of electric charge, the other one's a measure of the mass matter of objects. Both are born through observation of matter. Newton looked at the motion of the planets to formulate his law, and was the first to admit that even though the mathematics was there and it worked, he framed no hypothesis to explain the mechanics. Einstein tried to explain the mechanics because he realized that accelerating particles needed to be explained, accelerated motions. Special relativity only covered constant forces. Shall we reconnect for this last bit?
Yes, I'll come right back.
Yep.